sitting next to the 50s London serial killer, Christie, as he chopped up a victim in the bathtub. Photo by Deborah Turbeville. I couldn't take it all in. It was heaven. There were Mickey Mouse dolls, Carl Van Vechten and Walker Evans photos, Big Little books, Art Deco furniture, Charlie Chaplin posters, cigarette billboards, and racks of custom-made pimp shoes. He told me he'd once been written up in Time magazine just for painting Alvin Karpis, the 30s gangster. Those were the days, he said with a twinkle in his eye. He told me about going to a prize fight in evening dress with Jean-Paul Goud. When he came home, he had the red blood of the champion on the bosom of his boiled white shirt. I was most impressed. This Merkin character is the motherlode. September 11th. It's autumn in New York, on the wagon. Went to a party for Andy's new book, The Philosophy of Andy Warhol, at Leo Castelli's downtown gallery. I drank ginger ale. Makos introduced me to David Hockney, who looked great, with jutting chin and motorist cap pulled low over his round glasses. I asked about his possible show at the Met. It's off. People won't lend works. His trip to Alexandria. His crazy dad, who wears two watches, both broken. And his love for Fire Island. I went for 3 days and stayed 3 weeks. Then some strapping homosexuals whisked them away from me. Also, there was Kenzo, luminescent model Sarah Kapp, Mapplethorpe, Richard Bernstein, Florinda Balkin, Jane Forth, the Louds, Ronnie Catrone, who makes Andy's paintings, Henry Gelzeller, Taylor Mead, Leo Castelli with his Dalmatian dog, and Andy himself, blinking and smiling that awkward smile. Hundreds of models who all look the same. The idle rich and out for kicks, the hip intelligentsia, the cult heroes, the select few, the tastemakers, the ghosts from the past, the weirdos, the latest things. I left. McDermott had a 60s theme party. Craig dressed in a caftan, short hair parted in the middle, as though he was waiting for it to get long, but his mom wouldn't let him. Blue jeans and sandals, love beads, and a copy of Siddhartha, prominently clamped under his arm. We talked about the big summer story of the twin gynecologists, the Marcus brothers. New York Post headlines said, "Twin docs found dead in posh pad." A bizarre story. One died of a barbiturate withdrawal. The other lay down next to his twin and just died. A neighbor recognized the smell. Because I'd been in Korea. And they look exactly like the Everly brothers. Hence, I'm doing a double portrait of them, oil and canvas. Anyhow, I got plastered, and the devil got his money's worth that night. Kurt and I were watching the capture of Patty Hearst on TV. Brand new Minneapolis transplant Crosby comes over, looking like a mad scientist from an Edgar Allan Poe story. He's bubbling over with excitement about NYC, like a child who's found a hiding place that no one else knows about. He asks us if we had noticed that parts of the city are very pretty. Yes, we had. He asked us if we had noticed there were a lot of homosexuals here. Yes, we had. He asked if we had noticed that many of them wear beards. Yes, we laughed, pointing at his beard. Crosby says native New Yorker, like it's a Fulbright scholar or something. Any dumb cluck can park his butt in Sheridan Square, but to pee right in the middle of it, because you know it's okay, that is something else again. The street giveth, and the street taketh away. The Sacred and the Profane. Fall, 1975. What is that beat? It is myself. I'm pacing between the bedroom, the bathroom, the hall, the kitchen, the living room, navigating its length like a caged animal. I move things around. I empty ashtrays. Cognac pounding behind my eyes, behind my ears. One could get struck down at any moment. I write to seek redemption, to try to get a handle on things, to slow down the maximum speed of things. A guy in the street pointed a plastic pistol at me. I went down automatically. "Get out of here, kid, and fast." I slipped through the street, following a girl with a big mop of hair, thinking about the breasts that are concealed by her navy sweater. A pain stabbed my heart at the thought of this girl who I did not know, would never know. The world is too damn big. Excess of zeal. I go down to Pearl Paint with Crosby. He's studying old master techniques at the Art Students League. He likes to say, "Bend over, Luke, so's I can rim ya," in a hillbilly accent. I bought $70 worth of supplies, long taffy folds of Belgian linen, cans of dangerous sprays, charcoal. I also wanted the girl selling compasses on the fourth floor, felt the prick of sexual desire. It's called satyriasis. I'm low, loose, and full of juice. We trudge back and watch the third man, digging the zither music, marveling at Joseph Cotten's character, Western writer Holly Martin's. Love Trevor Howard's duffel coat, the cockeyed angles. I finish my twin gynecologist painting, overtones of Sheila in it. I practice drawing like Egon all the time. Wrote a little tune to go with it, to be sung to the Petty Duke Show theme. But they're doctors, identical doctors, and you'll find they walk alike, they talk alike, at times they even die alike. You will lose your mind with twin doctors who are two of a kind. I did another new painting called My Manhattan. It's a tall, thin canvas of a map of NYC featuring my haunts, the Strand, the 55, CBGB, etc., using stencils. I was so excited about it that I fell off the wagon. Crash! Nick had a little Kahlua and milk with me on top of his catnip buzz and fell off the desk and broke his tail. Now it looks like a crank, acting like the Bowery bum he is. Nothing like loving a sweet, dumb comic animal. He's better than the neurotic schnauzer I had as a kid, and better than Nancy, his predecessor, who split this scene via the fire escape. She was very disapproving of the goings-on around here. She wanted some nice old lady. I meant to be taking my portfolio around, but I loathe rejection. Who doesn't? I took it to Penthouse. They said it was fun. No job. I'm just stalling for time, stalling for breath. I'm a person of promise, living among other persons of promise. I'm crazy for knowledge. I play the fool. There's so much I don't know. Don't ask me. Christian and I crashed the preview of the new David Essex movie, Stardust, about the perils of being a pop star. It's a sequel to That'll Be the Day, which was excellent. This one was depressing. Marble's manager, Alan Betrock, got me into the press party on the 45th floor of the Time and Life building. The theme was all the fun at the fair, so there was a carnival set up with junk food to grow pimples with. I was more interested in the open bar. Eric and I secured a couple of scotch and sodas and started circulating. We spotted the bygone glitter stompers, Slade, whose single, Come On Feel the Noise, we delighted in as youths. We saw the great Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, who wrote some of my favorite songs ever. We chatted with Lee Childers and Danny Fields, who reproached me for being drunk already, only 9:15. Eric had to go, but I stayed on, in the grip of free drinks. I had four more, sitting alone at the window looking out at the shiny steel and glass below. The PA system boomed the Ronettes, and the TV broadcast the remaining inning of the World Series. I went back to sit at the bar and was joined by Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, whose hit Dream On can be heard everywhere. I eavesdropped on him was surprised at how stupid he seemed. I'd had enough. I was bored. I passed David Essex in the hall and said, "Rock on," the title of his hit single. He laughed. Down the elevator, down to the village, down to Craig's apartment, down to Reno Sweeney for unneeded nightcaps, and finally wobbled home, completely stewed. Crawled into bed at 2 a.m., fell asleep immediately. At 3:30, I got up to pee, and being too lazy to go the extra steps to the bathroom, I went to the bedroom window, which I assumed was open. It wasn't. So I pulled out my cock and began to whiz. It ricocheted all over, which woke Mary Jane up. She tried to stop me. I pulled the Venetian blinds over my head and kept peeing strong. Splash, splash. Mary Jane was yelling at me, so sensing disharmony, I punched out the window. Biff, bam, boom. I finished my pee through the broken window and crawled back into bed. Mary Jane is crying because her boyfriend is crazy and stupid and a jerk. After a bit, she gets back into bed, only to find it wet. He's peed in the bed, too? No, it's sticky. Smells like salt. Red corpuscles. She turned on the light. Eek! Blood everywhere. She gets up. I've got a gouge on the inside of my wrist that's gushing. An artery? She drags me into the bathroom, puts my arm up under cold water, waiting for the blood to start to clot, puts a tourniquet on me. She looks at my face. I'm not there. I begin babbling some noir dialogue. Ha! Your pretty face won't look so good once the boys are through, but I'm smart, see? Those big shots. They think they got me, but I'll get them first, see? Get the picture? Mary Jane has stopped the bleeding and leads me back to bed. She blots the blood with a towel and sits up crying. Next morning, I crack open one eye and vidy the gore. I have no recall. I say, what happened here? Did I try to kill myself or something? She says in exasperation, I don't know what you tried to do. She's filled with horror. She's looking at me funny. She leaves for work after leaving a big note on the refrigerator door that says, don't drink. The landlord came a-knockin' to see what had happened in the middle of the night. I told her a hat stand had toppled over and broke the window, while Kurt hurriedly balled up a bloody sheet so that she couldn't see. The landlord was very suspicious, but said she'd send the super up to replace the glass just the same. Kurt and I walked down to Fulton Street to have lunch at Sweets, oyster stew and fresh broiled sea bass, musing over the perverse fictions my mind travels in. The fresh air of the South Street seaport did me good. A mob of us went down to a new disco, One's, at 111 Hudson Street. We all got bombed and danced till 4 in the morning. I was kissing all my friends, boys and girls alike, as I tend to do when I'm in my cups, and wound up slow dancing with a nutty girl named Judy, which was pretty exciting, her alien body rubbing close to my heart on, swaying on her pegs, smoothing her shy breasts. She planted a big fizzy kiss in my mouth, cute as lace pants, as Raymond Chandler says. Yow! Anyhow, Crosby was sulking and gloomy, seemingly plagued by demons, and ran miles and miles in the rain, holding a lead pipe and smashing car windows. It's a bad week for windows. In fact, it's all-out war. Go to a party at Chris Makos's. It's filled with the fringe people that New York so warmly welcomes. Cynical Dotson Raider arrives very drunk, kisses everyone. He says, I hear you are unmakeable, a virgin. Very disapproving. When he leaves, I say, catch you later, Dot. Kurt and I go over to Crosby's new loft on 18th and Broadway. He's got a couple of dopey roommates. Steve and his girlfriend, Chris, who once remarked, "I love the way my tits smell in the morning." I pointed it at Taylor's dummy, standing in the middle of the rough floor, and said, "I wonder where Chris got that." Kurt replied, deadpan, "She cloned." Halloween party. Lance wore a Groucho nose and played Nino Rota records. Parsons' girl, T.F., came as the Crimson Princess in a transparent blouse, so in vogue these days. I have an eye for detail, especially where nipples are concerned. McDermott was dressed as a Bloomingdale's girl called Robin. He was fun until he had too many screwdrivers, became falling down drunk, lurching, spilling, ricocheting around. I aimed him at the bed the coats were on. He was out cold. Later, he slithered to the floor, where he vomited on himself, his wig, my portfolio, the carpet, everything. Crosby passed out next to him. They made a cute couple. I answered the door somewhere during the night and faced two of our men in blue. Uh-oh. I'm Stinko. The Everly brothers are blaring Till I Kissed You. They said someone had called the police because a fight had broken out in the hall. No problems here. Don't know anything about it, I said meekly. They were nice, maybe daunted by my full-dress tails. In the morning, my teeth were chattering due to my toxic content. Felt lousy. So I took an hour-long shower, hoping to steam out my cobwebs. The downstairs neighbor appeared at the door, in a hysterical state. I had somehow flooded her apartment due to my negligence. I set about mopping up my rainforest bathroom, throwing on towels, pajamas, submarines, deep sea divers, destroyers, any old thing. Then, the Spanish superintendent came up, a Jehovah's Witness, in a rage, eyeing the litter of dirty glasses and empty booze bottles with disbelief, a degeneracy beyond his imagination. He ordered Kurt to come downstairs and mop up the poor lady's apartment. The building was alive with discontent at my misbehavior. After we did what we could to appease the unhappy residents, we scrammed to the White Horse on Hudson, where Dylan Thomas had his last whiskeys. His last words before lapsing into an alcoholic coma were, "I've had 18 straight whiskeys. I think that's the record." It was a long day. Later that evening, I ran into my old girlfriend from Georgetown, the beautiful Jenna Weefa, who threw me over for Eno. She was with a new boyfriend, and they were wearing matching jodhpurs, which set me off for some reason, and I started growling and barking at them. I went all feral. She asked Craig to take good care of me. I have a new friend named John Meany, who I met at Carnegie Hall Cinema. He's a 28-year-old filmmaker who wants me to star in a production of Dorian Gray he's planning. He looks like a cross between Howdy Doody and Dirk Bogarde. We rendezvous at the 55 and listen to Sinatra's Angel Eyes. I love the sad atmosphere in there, lost in time. I ask Jimmy, the black bartender, for a Johnny Walker Red, and he fills a cocktail glass up to the top for $1.35. Scotsman's dream, in more ways than one. There's a 30-pound bar cat there called Crazy. A big sign outside says, "No dancing." I like that. I start to nod out, and Jimmy says, "Hey, you can't sleep here. This ain't no boarding house." We say bye to Crazy and leave. November 13th. Lunch with Kurt at Umberto's Clam House, where Joey Gallo got shot back in 1972. Doesn't look like a gangland kind of place. We gobbled down some fried cunts chased by Pepsi on ice. We talked about moving to Paris, being wild expats, making that existentialist scene. I went home and started stretching a canvas as I listened to Come Out by Steve Reich, an interesting, monotonous, modern sound collage. I walked into the bedroom and saw Mary Jane peeking through the slats of the Venetian blinds. So I started singing, "Peek-a-peek, peek-a-peek." She turned around, and her face was streaked with tears. She was sobbing. "What's the matter?" I said. "This record is driving me crazy." So I turned it off. Quite a tribute to the artist. Friday night at CBGB, freezing out. I got paid $10 for doing the pseudo Larry Rivers Marbles flyer. Marbles are on tonight and played Him or Me by Paul Revere and the Raiders. Howard Bowler had a beautiful new cherry red 12-string Rickenbacker that he used to great effect. Eric looked real sexy in Chinese. Dupre was heavy-lidded due to all the hemp he smoked. "Boy, you really look like a worm lately," he told me. "What's that supposed to mean?" Red-headed actress Lisa Persky was wearing some kind of kinky S&M getup, with cock rings, black boots, etc. I'm going to play her husband in an upcoming production of de Maupassant's Elaine, A Story of Lost Love. Someone's complaining about the social diseases that Richard Hell has been spreading as he cuts a swath through the female rock and roll contingent. Word has it that he's got a $25-a-day junk habit now. I was asking Marbles drummer Dave Bowler about that girl Judy that I slow danced with at the disco that night a couple of weeks ago. He said she was a fashion wholesaler, an uptown girl, not an easy lay, and yes, she did look like young Shirley MacLaine. I asked him what she wanted out of life, and he pondered this for a moment and then said, "Shoes." I went up to Atlantic Records with my portfolio to show Paula Chwast, Seymour's wife. She was nice. When I unzipped it on her desk, three cockroaches dashed out. She shrieked. I said, "Sorry." She went through carefully, said it was the sloppiest portfolio she'd ever seen. "I like that, but you may have gone a bit overboard. I like that your collages are on such shitty paper." She went on to call my work magnificent and amazing, but I will have trouble with art directors taking a risk with me because of the recession. She said there had been much talk about my Times pieces last spring, but no one dared use me again because my work seemed personal, not literal or universal. While I was jotting down her suggestions, my Pelican 120 exploded in my hand, showering sepia ink everywhere. I held up my paws for her to see and said, "Do you have a Kleenex?" She shook her head and said, "God, you're too much." We both laughed. November 24th, 1975. Homesick with the flu. Con Ed is after me for the $42 I owe them from last June. My bank account is overdrawn. But New York Magazine came out today with my illustration of Paul Simon, $100. And I'm reading a huge biography of Modigliani that is incredibly inspirational. I identify with him in a big way, which is both good and bad. At 23, he was already a wreck, sitting slack and stupefied in an artificial paradise of alcohol and hashish, living badly, but working calmly. Careless, reckless, childish, prickly, uproarious, frenzied, undomesticated, rooted in unreality with the rest of the damned, resilient enough to rebound, a sensitivity brought to the breaking point, living on nerve alone, and then not living at all. Kurt and I saw Eclipse at a Fifth Avenue cinema. Antonioni begins with spare imagery, a fan blowing Monica Vitti's hair, lawn sprinklers, geometric landscapes, and the contemporary wastelands of Rome. She dresses up like an African tribal dancer and swivels her sarong to the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom, the boom, boom, boom of the drum. She meets sharp 25-year-old stockbroker with sports car eyes, Alain Delon, who's obsessed with buy and sell. The beast is calling for me. I'll see you tonight. She's a vulnerable Madonna of true love. He's a money-grubbing swinger. In the inevitable seduction scene, Delon is following her through an old-world apartment, brutally rips her white satin dress. She picks up one of those pens with a pettigirl in a one-piece bathing suit, and when she turns it upside down, the suit disappears, and there's the same girl, front and back, in the nude. Delon is clumsy and confused by this ethereal beauty, who is worlds away from him. The theater is silent, except for the ticking of my watch. Delon dramatically pushes her onto the bed, holds his hand over her breast for a full 45 seconds. He raises a brow over his bedroom eyes. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, contact. They consummate their tense attraction. Vidi finds she has actually fallen in love with this shallow creep. But her love is a faith healer, which pulls the ground from under his feet. He is in unknown territory, the land of love. Finding out that they can't part for even a moment without feeling totally lost. They didn't know what they were getting in for. They go over the scenes of how they first began, which take on an ominous importance. Antonioni ends the film this way. The same locations, but devoid of life, to the haunting score by Giovanni Fusco. The drip, drip, drip of modern civilization. Will they go on to a happy ever after future? Or will decay set in? Does love always lead to pain? These and other questions must remain unanswered. Thanksgiving, Coney Island. Spent the raw, overcast day clowning around on the deserted beach with the Minneapolis expats. The Atlantic Ocean crashing up to us as we pass a bottle of dark Bacardi rum between us. Big sky looked down and all the little people looking up at the big sky, sang Ray Davies. And indeed, the scarlet fingertips of sunset tussle our hair. There's the Dayglow Wonder Wheel, set off against the gunmetal gray sky. We're dressed like Depression-era bank robbers. We smoke camels on the wet sand. Read Herbert Asbury's The Gangs of New York aloud, about such notables as Louis the Lump and Kid Twist. Talking about girls and art and beatniks and Dash Hammett. Talking through our hats. Pissing under the boardwalk. Feeling free of the familial commitments that we had all grown up with. Getting down and getting with it, as the revolutionaries would say. Walking out in the breakers to suck in the sea air. Euphorically drunk. The sheer ecstasy of realizing each moment. When we squint, we can see all the way across the ocean to France and just barely make out the Eiffel Tower. Hooligans on holiday. Thanksgiving dinner was fried shrimps and French fries at Nathan's Famous Frank's. Cold beer. Beware of good taste. So many friends of mine fall into the trap laid by the crossword puzzle of New York culture, taking their media injections of reviews, trivia, in-jokes, and fashionable opinions, sliding into the niche of the preordained chic taste with its comfortable boundaries, a schematic reference point from which to stand above it all. Get your hands dirty. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. There is no empirical truth. Good taste can dampen creativity, make you inhibited, make you shy away from out-of-reach glories. Pasolini is dead, bludgeoned to death by 17-year-old rough trade, then run over by his own sports car, fulfilling his predestination. I went up to John Barrett's for dinner. I sat on his brown velvet couch and drank scotch while we listened to Miles Davis' Porgy and Bess. On the walls were original Peter Arno cartoons. He made pork chops. He's a consulting editor for Esquire and New York Magazine. Friends with Peter Beard. Was at the famous Democratic Convention in Chicago with Genet, Burroughs, Ginsburg, etc. Michael Hare's dispatches were originally organized by John for Esquire, so he's been around. Interesting cat. When he found I didn't have subway fare home, he slipped me a 10-spot for the starving artist. David McDermott proposed marriage to Mary Jane. He's waiting for the opportunity of my eventual leaving so he can get the dirty dishes. He wants to be Andy Hardy, he says. Mary Jane's diary says, I live with the most inconsiderate and irresponsible boy I ever met in my life. A bottle and two glasses. Crosby and I are drinking rum and smoking marijuana while watching Kiss Me Deadly on The Late Show, an apocalyptic movie, if ever there was one. Marijuana brings me into the present. Presently, Nick is chewing on my hand. If I died, he'd eat my arm off. I look above the little white TV to my big cork bulletin board. There's a silkscreen of Eddie Cochran on it that I got at Let It Rock on King's Road. Also, a cutout of Uschi Obermeyer with her hand down her unzipped jeans. Her bangs in her eyes, her pouting mouth, her nipples standing straight up. She's part of some anarchist German group, but still manages to model for Avedon and screw Keith Richards. She's the one who slipped ace guitarist Peter Green too much acid, and he lost his mind and gave her radical group all his money. A modern-day femme fatale, to be sure. Crosby says, Nick, quit stamping your feet. When he gets up to leave, he says, Time for these boot heels to be ramblin'. I'm making the rounds of some art dealers. They say they can't launch an unknown. No coterie backing me. Nothing solid underfoot. It's a catch-22 situation. My day will come. Roxy music at the beautiful Beacon Theater. Larry Rivers was in the lobby with his girlfriend, my Parsons pal, Shelley Dunn. Larry looks good, with his long silver hair swept back, his lined face, his hooked nose, cowboy shirt, painter's pants, and long silver fox fur coat. I talked with him a little while, asked him too many questions, but I'd just seen Pull My Daisy, which blew my mind. Larry played a subway train conductor. Kerouac's spontaneous voiceover was so pretty and lyrical. Up you go, little smoke. Ginsburg and Corso, mischievous beatniks. Delphine Sirig was Larry's wife. David Amram's lovely score. The theme song I shall want played at my funeral. That's how good it is. Christmas in Minneapolis. Cocktail hour with Dad before dinner. When Mom calls, Dinner's ready, Dad says, Let's have a rammer, which is a glass of bourbon to be thrown down the hatch 30 seconds before you sit down to the dinner table. Candlelight and wine. Dad discusses the troubled world we live in. It gets him down. He turns the conversation to me and my struggle to make it. At one point he says, Look, I don't know anything about art, and I don't care. Will it be ever thus? It's snowing outside the window. Back in NYC, Blondie's playing at Max's. They were fun. Getting professional. Clem Burke is a real show drummer. Crosby and I were drugged and rummed over, passing a pint under the table, pouring more spirits down to keep spirits up. He says of Debbie, I would gladly eat her nylons, wouldn't you? I say there are a number of things that come to mind that I'd rather do with Debbie, but okay, sure, if that's your thing, man. I'm reading through the night with wide eyes, a biography of Sax Rohmer, best-selling creator of Fu Manchu, who's been something of a talisman to me. Sax was a born raconteur, gave nicknames to everybody, belonged to the eccentric club. The Côte d'Azur, Cairo, Limehouse, Paris. This is where you can find Sax. His walls were decorated with unframed photographs of girls, overdressed, underdressed, or not dressed at all. God bless Fu Manchu. Also reading Ann Charter's bio of Kerouac, which initially thrilled me, but as his alcoholism took over, scared me. He finally hemorrhaged on his mother's basement floor in Florida while watching The Galloping Gourmet on morning television, only 47. The booze turned him into all the things he'd been against. He became homophobic, commie-fearing, bigoted, right-wing. A sad trajectory. So this is my role model? I don't want to end up like that. I must reassess. If all my romantic plans are nothing but pipe dreams, then I've been delusional. Precious youth is eking through my fingers. I promptly went on the wagon. Out of context. February, 1976. Norman Fisher had a party for the mumps in his new Abington Square penthouse, with a terrace that looks out over Greenwich Village. Henry Geldzahler was there, admired my smooth forehead. He introduced me to rumpled genius Robert Frank. I gushed to him about my admiration for his body of work, which I realized was a mistake. He said, "Who cares?" I shot craps with Jane Forth. I sat with singer Robert Palmer, who wondered where I got my haircut. "Mary Jane in the kitchen," I said. He wanted to make an appointment, thinking it was a salon. I laughed. Then he wanted to know where I got my corduroy suit. I told him it was an old Brooks Brothers number that I dyed with plum-colored writ in the bathtub. He seemed disappointed that he couldn't go out and get this stuff. But it's all do-it-yourself around here. I stayed late, sniffing cocaine and drinking liqueurs. Norman said, "Don't worry, I'm not going to try to seduce you, though you wouldn't do poorly to take on an older man as a lover. But as for me, I'll take whatever I can get, and if that means friendship, I'll take it." Lance returned from his sexual ramblings, and we watched the sun come up. The arrival of another new day. We felt the mystery and strangeness of a world out of whack. I was wasted. I have a tendency to throw myself away. No parachute, free fall, fucked up. Lance gave me a bath like a brother, wrapped me in a robe and put me to bed. He's always been protective of me. Joseph Astor got a job as Irving Penn's assistant. Dupre got a 1957 Ampeg amp called a reverber rocket. Richard Lloyd got a job as a bartender at a new joint called Pix. Eric Lee is working as a computer programmer by day, rock star by night. John Meany is driving a cab and got kicked in the face by a 14-year-old black kid in Harlem. The best new band are the Talking Heads, preppy RISD kids. They have a great song called Tentative Decisions. I've been working for a new periodical called New York Rocker. For the first issue, I did a map to the stars' homes, where all the underground pop stars came from. I was paid with a two-record set of psych pop band The Idle Race, Jeff Lynne's band Before the Move, or ELO. I bought an astroscope, an opaque projector, from Pearl Paint, which means I can utilize photographs to a greater extent. This triggered a burst of painting with acrylic. Direction comes from working, not from my critical brain. Critics' time and creators' time are not the same time. New paintings. 1. Je t'aime, Jane B., of Jane Birkin standing in a doorway with her hand down her blue jeans. 2. Subtitles. Done from a still from Breathless, of Belmondo in a nude in an interior. 3. Crime of Passion. A gun still life in my poetry with Jasper John's monochromatic scumbling. 4. The Prince of Bohemia, Modigliani. 5. Carol Lindley topless, in front of the Vlaminck, brushing her hair. I was in the 8th Street bookshop and spied Hockney, who had had a dream about the night before. He was hunched over in a tan overcoat, his roots showing. I approached him and said, "David?" He turned around, eyebrows raised in curiosity. "I'm Duncan Hanna. I met you at a party." We talked. He gave me his number. I gave him my card, which said, "Painter of Pictures," on it. He smiled. He peered closely at me. He invited me over for tea at 33 West 9th Street. I arrived, playing it by ear, not knowing what to expect. We sat around a glass coffee table, drinking tea in Henry's basement. Several large gray cats prowled about. David and Henry quizzed me about my painting, my income, my parents. We discussed art. If art really progressed, then that, pointing at a generic abstraction on the wall, would be better than Caravaggio, David said. He is such an intelligent, funny, and classical man. Henry rubbed his socked foot against my penny loafer experimentally as he pontificated about his views on art history. David rolled his eyes and said, "You must take everything Henry says with a grain of salt." He tends to go on a bit. We laughed. They smoked cigars and argued about contemporary art. I smoked cigarettes and jumped in when I could. Henry asked David if he was going to draw me. "I don't know, maybe, we'll see," he said in his broad Bradford accent. So began a week of Hockney. The next night they took me to a small dinner at his dealer's house, Robert Miller, who had married a Johnson & Johnson heiress, which explained the deluxe Upper East Side brownstone they lived in. I wore the YSL black velvet suit I got at Barney's, with a striped sailor's jersey and my best burgundy loafers from Botticelli. Miller kept playing Pachelbel's Canon over and over, which has been newly rediscovered, hauntingly beautiful. I asked him what it was. He told me. I couldn't hear him right and said, "Taco Bell?" incredulously. "Pachelbel," he replied angrily. "Oops." I had offended the host, who seemed put out that David had brought a nobody guest. His mother was there. It was all terribly civilized. David and I kept up a steady conversation with each other about art history, agreeing on most things. He did not condescend, ever. It was like we were peers. A very generous attitude for a guy who was an international art superstar. We took a cab home, and as we passed my street, I said, "I can hop out here." They said nothing. The cab kept sailing down the avenue, turned on 9th, stopping at Henry's. I wondered what was expected of me. The moment of truth was upon me. I got out and extended my hand, saying, "Thank you so much, guys. What a fun evening. I hope to see you tomorrow." They exchanged a glance and shook my hand silently. David said, "Yes, well, all right. I'll give you a ring." I disappeared feeling like Cinderella. Shall I turn into a pumpkin at midnight? David came over for tea the next day, sat in the divan in my studio, and leafed through my drawings and collages, studied my paintings, all without a word. He smoked a cigar. He told me about seeing Elvis in Vegas. I took a couple of snaps of him. Very surreal, seeing him sitting there under a framed photo of himself on which I had inscribed, "For my dear Duncan, lots of love, XXOO, David H." I'd forgotten it was there, but it didn't escape his eye, and he looked at me with a puzzled expression. He left. He called later and told me to meet him at Balducci's, where he was picking up a few edibles. When we were outside, I said, David, it was great you came over to look at my work, but you didn't say anything. He paused. He'd been expecting this. We've been talking for a few days now. You're obviously a very smart guy. I don't have to tell you about your work. You already know. I'll just say this. You're selling yourself short in an attempt to be stylish. There's something of the zeitgeist in your work that weakens it. You're probably worried about having a look. Don't worry about that. That will come by itself. Just work hard, and you will evolve into yourself naturally. Don't choose who to be. Grow into yourself through hard work. All will be revealed. I guarantee that if you paint a still life, it will have your personality in it. You have to trust that. The best things I saw by you today were your self-portrait drawings, because they had no artifice. Your drawing is a bit heavy-handed, in the American fashion. The English draw in a finicky way. The French have got it right. If I was you, I would strip away all your flashy gimmicks and dare to make plain paintings. You will be original. You have to take it on faith. You know what to do. You'll get where you need to go with time and hard work. I nodded and thanked him. I knew I was hearing the truth and appreciated his candor, but still, it was very sobering to hear it from someone I respected so much. He left the next day for Los Angeles. Today I found a copy of the French glossy Realités in the basement of the apartment building. Cover had a color picture of Nureyev. Someone had scrawled across his regal face with black magic marker, "Commie faggot shit." America hates beauty and is continually trying to destroy it. Reading list. You Can't Go Home Again, Thomas Wolfe. Hope of Heaven, John O'Hara. Quiet Days in Clichy, Henry Miller. This Gun for Hire, Graham Greene. Standing Still and Walking in New York, Frank O'Hara. The Big Laugh, John O'Hara. Notebooks, Claes Oldenburg. New Records. Helen of Troy, John Cale. Jazz Impressions of New York, Dave Brubeck Quartet. Captain Marvel, Stan Getz. Ruth is Stranger Than Richard, Robert Wyatt. The Trog's Greatest Hits. The Royal Scam, Steely Dan. Wild Honey, The Beach Boys. Between the Buttons, The Rolling Stones. She Was Too Good to Me, Chet Baker. Communications, Stan Getz. Desire, Bob Dylan. Blue Afternoon, Tim Buckley. Movies. Bambina, Algiers. Pepe Lamoco. Thy Creatures. Je T'aime, Je T'aime. The Naked Kiss. The Lovers. A Very Private Affair. Flesh. Les Deluxe. It's already springtime. Tweet, tweet. Nick got his balls cut off at the vet on 10th Street. I waited for him at the Lion's Head. He'll take a fish tail, turn it into a fish scale. Meanie's got a friend of a friend who got castrated by some S&M guys last week. Eric got mugged when he was high on downers. Gimette Barbé got her camera stolen. E.S. Weilens's 8th Street bookshop burned down. There's a full moon all this week that's got all the ghosts and skeletons jittery. It gets crazy around here, and none of us have stuntmen to fill in for us. David Hockney is off on an exotic vacation with his studio assistant, Gregory Evans. I got a postcard from him. It was a picture of a South Sea island, and written with flourish, it says, "Love from Bora Bora, XXOO, David H." A real sentiment to replace my forged sentiment. Crosby and I sit down to drink a bottle of cheap Beaujolais. Crosby has the long-suffering look of a man forced to live with mental defectives. He resembles the actor Herbert Lom. He suffers from a kind of grandiose flamboyance, morbid self-attention, but he's funny. He says, "It's a naive domestic vintage, but I think you'll be amused by its pretension. Here we are, the creative poor, locked in our grimy hobo towers, talking about pencil lines and gestalt and flying fish and torch singers and grades of canvas. We smoke some pot and hit the street, pass a garbage truck in flames. We go over to Phoebe's for some rum and overhear an NYU girl introduce her gay friend to her mother. 'Mom, this is Carl. He's the most pretentious guy I know.' Carl beams broadly and says, 'It's all true.' It's the height of wimpiness." Crosby returns home with me to watch some old movies on TV. A Place in the Sun had us biting our nails as tragic destiny unwound itself. Poor Monty. Then, Bullets for Ballots, about racket busters. Then Crossroads, with William Powell, as an amnesiac, and that beautiful ecstasy girl, Hedy Lamarr. She invented sonar. When it began to get light out, Crosby said, "Throw a couple of drops of ink in the dawn, will you, Dunk?" When I eventually went to sleep, I dreamt I was being tried for murder. Nothing creates a bohemian faster than a steady check from bourgeois parents. George Bernard Shaw. Up at McDermott's salon, he is putting out a society magazine called The Cottage, 4 pages long, printed at Insti Prints. Christian lives with him now. He excels at rude remarks that pass for humor. He utilizes a brittle mechanized wit, very arsenic and old lace. Christian's collections of Dolly's and Beatles memorabilia have been relegated to the closet. The Kramers are sitting on the couch, chewing gum and wearing baby clothes. Kramer is quiet, no longer a big fish in a small pond. NYC is a giant rubber-coated playpen. And all the nuts equalize each other out. We go out for a walk in Central Park, through the Ramble, where young men make wordless assignations. Up to the castle, a weather station that looks down over Shakespeare in the Park. McDermott is decked out in his turn-of-the-century finery. Skateboarding children shriek at him. "Hey, mister! Are you gay? Ha 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 ha!" Last night, Craig and I went to the Bottom Line to see the first post-recording gig of the Ramones. It was short, sweet, and to the point. Hilarious. I was meant to be shooting for New York Rocker, so I had to elbow 10 other photographers with their 2-foot lenses. Headliners were England's Dr. Feelgood, featuring guitarist Wilco Johnson, a skinny, demented lad who abused his Telecaster relentlessly. Afterwards, we went up to Rockefeller Plaza at midnight for a $15,000 press party outdoors for Aerosmith, who had just played The Garden. A cha-cha band played under the 30 Rock building. The lights twinkled on the fountain and the huge gold sculpture of Prometheus. I was reminded that this was where Sunday in New York was shot, with the alluring Jane Fonda. She's not here tonight. But Lee Childers is, next best thing. We sampled the buffet, roast beef, croissant, etc. Saucer-eyed girls with red mouths and telltale nipples prowled for pickups. The creme de la creme, wine stewards everywhere. I joined Warhol and Lance, who has just resigned from his post at Interview and Circus magazine. He's also getting evicted. Andy smiled at me with curiosity, and shyly said the three of us should get together some night. We said we'll take him to CBGB to see the Talking Heads. Craig and I left the party at 2:30, took the subway downtown for a bottle of Bud at the 55, where the literary drunks were installed, and to play Pull My Daisy on the juke, capping off a perfect night. Bless our immortal souls. New paintings. La Coule. Hotel. Film Noir. Ignition, Delon. Colored Girl, Aurore. Accomplices, Birkin. Espionage, Bogart and Ogier. Ivory, Serpa Lane. Joe Brainard had a show at the Fishback Gallery of hundreds of small collages. Inspirational. He has an odd color scheme, gray, peach, turquoise, black, and white. His themes are martini glasses, shirts and ties, snowing paper clips, Ritz crackers, tropical fish, cigarettes, travel stickers, stamps, sandwiches, posies, ashtrays, plaid, TV sets, etc. There's an article about him in a new magazine called People. John's is at Castelli, Klimt and Schiele at the Austrian Institute. Motherwell, ochre, brick, beige, black, gray. Twombly scribbles white crayon over wet gray oil. Phony documents, blackboards, ghosts. Try it. I like the cubist painter, Roger de la Fresnay. Stroll down to Pier 42 and its burned-down twin, an evil-looking place. Spray-painted signs warn innocents about danger. Nude silhouettes of male buttocks slide across the windowsills. I talked with a beautiful girl, Apollonia van Ravenstein, I think, who pulled up on her white Raleigh. Black hair, no eyebrows, red lips, Bronx voice, tiny jean jacket over bursting white t-shirt, turquoise velvet pants, wine red Italian boots. Yum, yum. I asked her what the little crystal piece around her neck was. Balls, she answers. She pedaled off. CBGB with Warhol. Lance and I escort the Prince of Pop to a ringside table for the Talking Heads show. Andy orders us a round of Jack Daniels. Lance warns him, "Watch out for Duncan's drinking. Did you ever see a balloon and a radiator? Well, that's Duncan. He becomes a ghost of his former self." Andy seems to have a child's sense of wonder, very inquisitive, very sweet and polite. He gives me an American flag that he has autographed. A bicentennial gift, he says. He slips Lance $40 spending money. The Heads are playing a song called Artists Only. I don't have to prove that I am creative. We were joined by Chris Blackwell of Island Records, singer Robert Palmer, and the very ambitious Robert Mapplethorpe. "They're so cute," drawled Andy of the band. "We should do something on them for the magazine. Do you think they'd like to come up for lunch?" I said that yes, they probably would. Duh. I'd arrange it. Tuesday lunch with Warhol, May 26, 1976. I got to the factory a little early, being led in by English Rose receptionist Catherine Guinness. Andy was alone and offered to show me his studio. There were a lot of pet portraits on the wall. "Do you have a pet?" he asked. "Yes, I have a little black cat called Nick Charles," I said. "Oh, what a good name. Do you think Nick would like his portrait painted?" "I'm sure he would, but I don't think his finances would cover it," I smiled. "What about your parents? Would they like a portrait of Nick Charles?" he asked. Seeing where he was going with this, I marveled at his chutzpah.